This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Birrarung peoples. We'd like to pay our respects to their elders past and present, acknowledge that sovereignty over this land was never ceded, genocide and colonization are still ongoing on this land, and that this land always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hey, hello, welcome to the next episode of Ozpol Snack Pod.
Yeah, you heard right. Thank you for all of your extremely unhelpful suggestions. We've decided to ignore them.
Yeah, they were all somehow worse than the suggestions that we came up with, that we, when we were coming up with them, were like, let's think of some bad names so other people will suggest better ones. But you really surpassed all our expectations.
Now this is Oz podcasting is way too long for me to fit into the theme song, so here we are.
Snack pod.
How are we going to justify that, Nu?
Well, this is the podcast where we serve you bite-sized chunks of news with a side of crispy memes.
I think we can get away with that.
Yeah, that's a good enough reason. Plus, you're Zach LeSnack. We should also introduce ourselves.
Oh, yeah. So, I'm Zach LeSnack. I am on the Ozpol Shitposting Facebook page.
And I'm Noon, I'm the admin, aka I Know Funkenstein.
And yeah, thanks for joining us. What are you snacking on this week?
This week I went down to Subway for a nuclear sub. I just want to make it clear that I'm not paying for that with illegal corrupt money. I just want to make that extremely clear. That nuclear sub,
it's all above board.
It's completely fine.
Clean sub money.
Yeah. I'm also just having a side of a single dehydrated carrot, which is the entirety of this year's Australian foreign aid budget.
So I feel like you started with a pretty deep cut.
Yeah, true. Yeah, it's true.
Would you like to elaborate?
I was thinking about something like a pine mushroom sauté or something.
Pine nut. I don't know. I just feel like so many Christopher Pine jokes have been made.
Yeah.
But anyway, please explain what you're talking about.
So I'm having this particular snack to celebrate / commiserate about the blatant corruption in our parliament, or outside of our parliament, I should say, because this week we found out that Julie Bishop and Chris Pine, former frontbenchers in the Liberal government who quit at the last election because they thought they were going to lose, have very corruptly taken jobs that are, like, inside the purview of the ministerial roles that they had. So Chris Pine has got a job as a defence contractor with EY, and he was the defence minister, or the defence apparel minister.
EY being one of the big four accounting firms who basically run a bunch of the chunks of the government on their behalf. Anything that they want to outsource
goes to big accountancy firms, including EY. Yeah. So Chris Pine is there helping them figure out defence things and about how to buy nuclear submarines on behalf of the government, whatever. So that's obviously super corrupt. And then
What did Julie get up to?
Julie Bishop got a job with an aid contractor called Palladium, who are basically exactly the same as EY, except they only do development things. They're like the big faceless international megacorp for international development.
So why isn't anything being done about this? If this is so obviously wrong, what rules are they breaching and how can they be punished?
So the rules that they're breaching are in the Ministerial Code of Conduct, which is a set of completely unenforceable rules that are only
cool system.
Yeah, so cool. I love accountability and transparency. So these are rules in the Ministerial Code of Conduct, which is only enforceable by the Prime Minister on his ministers. And
so it's not like legally enforceable?
No, it's not. The Prime Minister can make his ministers resign. But there's this rule that says that for 18 months after you leave the government, you're not supposed to take a job that's in the same field as the portfolio that you had responsibility for. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me, and a lot of other people, that in both of these cases of Chris Pine and Julie Bishop, it's just like a blatant violation of that rule. And the government has in fact promised to look into it. I think they're having some kind of inquiry, which is pretty huge considering that you got to assume that Scott Morrison doesn't really want to investigate his former colleagues for corruption. Yeah. But presumably he's also going to find that regardless of whether or not they did break the rule, he can't do anything about it. So it's probably safe to do the inquiry.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what are the potential consequences for them, even if they are found to have breached the ministerial standards?
Yeah, almost nothing.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Possibly Scott Morrison and the government will make a big noise about how they shouldn't have done it. But I think it's very unlikely that either of them will lose their jobs as a result, because the Prime Minister doesn't actually have any direct power there.
Hmm. It's kind of weird to consider that the Parliament has never actually created any enforceable guidelines to stop themselves being super corrupt.
Yeah, that's a bit kind of strange.
Bit of coincidence? Anyway.
So, Zach, what are you snacking on this week? Tell, what are you having?
I'm having Chicken McKenzie nuggets with a secret spice recipe.
Oh, what's secret about the spice recipe?
Well, let me backtrack a little bit. So, Bridget McKenzie, who's the new agriculture minister, the deputy of the Nationals, has just had a bill introduced into the parliament which is going to introduce much steeper penalties for animal activists breaking onto agricultural property. This is in the wake of the Dominion protest. You might remember the Melbourne CBD was shut down by a big sit-in. And concurrently with that protest, there are a number of other smaller actions that happened around the country involving activists breaking onto farms and trying to rescue, liberate animals.
I do remember hearing about that, yeah.
And yeah, then the government kind of turned it into a bit of a culture war issue. Obviously, farmers being the backbone of this nation is a favourite conservative talking point. So the Morrison government had been making a lot of noise about bringing in harsher penalties for people doing this kind of thing. And Bridget McKenzie, her first order of business as the new ag minister, replacing outgoing David Littleproud, from who himself replaced Barnaby Joyce. Her first order of business has to get this bill introduced, which is going to bring in maximum jail sentences of up to 5 years for this stuff.
Whoa.
And fines of $2.1 million.
Whoa, holy crap.
Yeah, so it's
all of those wealthy animal activists.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is troubling for a number of respects. Obviously, it's part of a broader kind of more authoritarian attitude towards protests, which we're seeing across the country, both at a federal and state level, in terms of the way that government's reacting to this kind of thing. It's also troubling because it's a real step backwards for the government's attitudes towards this kind of thing. When David Littleproud replaced Barnaby Joyce, he brought a much more kind of collaborative and comparatively progressive stance on this, on a lot of issues, including working with animal rights groups, for example, to help shut down the live export trade, which is still operating but is kind of has been hobbled. Bridget McKenzie has come back in and said, no, we love live export, we're going to try and remove all restrictions on live export.
It's also about climate change, right?
Yeah, this is an attempt to prop up an animal agriculture industry that we know is, you know, should be condemned to the dustbin over the next coming decades, because it's a massive contributor to climate change. So this is going to put another obstacle for animal activists who want to expose what's happening on factory farms, terrible animal conditions, which are, I think, an important arm of the fight to get these industries shut down and help us transition away from animal agriculture. So it's bad news. She's bad news. This is not good news.
Wow, that sounds like bad news.
Oh, so yeah, that's why the secret recipe. Because we're not going to be able to know what's happening in farms anymore.
Nice.
Unless people want to go to prison.
Cool, so that's our snack pack for the week, or snack box, or lunch snacks.
Yeah, have we justified the new name to you yet?
Snack pod.
Are you buying
snack
it?
Pod, yeah. Cool, so
let's move on to
Shitpost of the week.
So, we're trying something a little different this time. We've got a few different contenders for Shitpost of the Week. Yeah, so, we had first up, first-time poster Leah Weitzel, had an excellent photo of,
a racist in the wild.
Yeah.
In his natural environment.
It was Mark Latham, chilling out, Max, and relaxing at an airport, and looking like a smug dickhead.
It just enrages me that he's allowed to walk around pretending like he is a normal person who deserves to exist and not be harassed everywhere that he goes.
And to be clear, Leah and Helena, we're not calling you out for not egging / milkshaking Mark Latham. That is completely reasonable to not do that.
Mm, we're just saying that he should be.
Someone should, yeah.
Yeah. So that's one contender. We also have the Greens Shadow Cabinet shit post, which it's an official post, so I don't know if it's, you know, if it can ever be that shit of a post, but the Greens basically saying that Labour has rolled over and is not being a proper opposition, so they've appointed themselves opposition and given themselves a number of shadow cabinets, including a number of new, I guess you'd call them fictional, cool ones.
I didn't notice that. I didn't read it in great detail. I was like, I get the joke.
Yeah, there's a couple of good ones.
Yeah, anyway, Haim Tay, noted Greens hack, posted that one. So good one, Haim, bringing that good content. To be clear, I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. We love bipartisan hacks.
Oh, we're all hacks.
Of all stripes, so, yeah.
Not hiding that.
We also had a contender, another, for the second week in a row, Van Badham. And Zach, before the podcast, said that we can only have this as a contender for Shit Post of the Week if I promise we don't talk about Van for another 2 weeks.
Please. And enough Van content.
Yeah, look, everyone's had enough Van content, but this one was particularly exciting because she wrote an editorial for The Guardian in which she complained about the Labour Party being neoliberal shills passing regressive tax cuts. And I just can't even... There's no words for how... Van. But look, to be fair, she followed it up with a tweet saying that the Greens were also neoliberal shills. So...
Fair and balanced, TM.
It's true. She could be on the ABC.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't know. I guess she has the occasional good opinion as well.
Yeah.
That's what makes her such a... spicy take generator.
That's very true.
Yeah.
All right, and we've got one more, also for the second week in a row.
Yeah, Chris Ritchie coming back with that crunchy OC, last week's winner. He's got this very fresh new Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego meme redone as Where in the World is any semblance of backbone from Labour MPs and senators I used to respect, which I think is a sentiment that we can all sympathise with.
100%, yeah.
Yeah. And look... I kind of got to say, I feel like this might be the best shit post that we've had on the page this week. I know it's a little, bit rough for everybody else to see Chris take it out 2 weeks in a row, but he's put in the work.
Chris, you're doing a bang-up job. You're shitposting cromulently. You're really embiggening the page. Everyone else, you're terrible and should feel ashamed and
your content is
make
soggy,
more memes.
Not nearly crispy enough.
Yeah, that crispy Chris... Richie goodness.
So, congratulations, Chris, on taking out the prize for a second week in a row. So, Noon, when he's talking about where's Labour's backbone, where's that coming from?
Yeah, so this is really the big piece of news this week, is that Labour rolled over and supported the government tax cuts. They tried to move a couple of amendments to the bills that I think were completely sensible ones, moving the second stage forward and not including the third bit that was only for the rich, and seems like a pretty sensible amendment. But they did possibly the worst thing that you can do while negotiating, which is that up front they told everyone that if they didn't get what they wanted, they would still support the government. Which
seems like bad politics.
Really? You think...
It looks very similar.
Before you start, might not be a good strategy. Look, this little bit of the podcast is just going out for any Labour MPs that might be listening to this show for some reason. There's this book that I can recommend. It's called The Art of the Deal by Donald J. Trump. And maybe you could just give it a little once-over and next time not be such spineless shitbricks.
Yeah, so... I mean, this is it's a funny one because the Libs had secured the support of the crossbench that they needed to pass this bill anyway. They, you know, Jackie Lambie did sort of attach her own, you know, she got something for her constituents out of it.
Probably.
Most likely.
Yeah.
Getting some social housing debt erased. So, like, that's another case of Jackie going into bat for her constituents, which is another... tick in the plus column against the column, a minus column that is also chock-a-block with Islamophobia and a bunch of other dumb shit. So she continues to confound and surprise.
Yeah, Jackie is unlike everyone else in the parliament in that she seems like she's probably an actual human being.
Mm, which is nice, but also like an actual human being. Who she says and does a bunch of really dumb and...
brown migrants. And, yeah. Yeah.
Troubling.
So, just about Jackie, I just also wanted to say there was some reporting that she was trying to make a deal with the government where she would get, as Zach said, $150 odd million of housing debt that the Tasmanian state government has spent on social housing, get that erased. And it seems like she hasn't actually got that in the bag. The government has been very vocal about saying they didn't make any deals to get this tax cut passed. But the Centre Alliance and Jackie Lambie people have been acting as though they got a deal made. So I suspect that in the next couple of months, the government will announce a few policy items about housing and maybe some other things. I don't know what the Centre Alliance people were asking for, but that will be the other end of this deal. So we've just seen the front end.
Sure.
And look, I got to say, I know they actually like know each other, but I wouldn't trust Matthias Cormann to hold up his end of the deal after he got his tax cuts through.
Nah, he's definitely one of the slimier folks floating around the halls of parliament.
That was a nice thing about the recent Lib spill, is that a lot of the shine got taken off him, because he was seen as a real, like, right and proper dude, and then got shown up to be an absolute
opportunist, greedy, power-grabbing scumbag, which, of course, he's a politician. So, like... and so just before we get off this... We've pointed out that the Liberals had enough support without Labour in order to get this stuff passed. Why did Labour then vote for it? Where's the political loss in opposing it?
So I think there's a few different things. One is that Albanese has been for the last like 6 years positioning himself as more like business friendly, economic, less socialist, more in favour of the wealthy than Bill Shorten. And now he's trying to live up to that by passing regressive tax cuts. But I think also if Labour had voted against it, the government would have spent the next literally 3 years talking about how Labour hates tax cuts, wants higher taxes, doesn't want money in the pockets of the working class, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that maybe they would have said that anyway?
What do you mean? Even if Labour had passed it?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think so. It's
okay.
Being passed... they did pass it, and I don't think the government can really say that, because they voted for it, but...
Interesting. So you think that this maybe there was a little bit of a political... Like, that wasn't necessarily a bad political move?
I think it was a bad political move, because whatever gain you might get from, like, centrists who support progressive taxation, but also less progressive taxation... you're going to lose in people like you and me who don't like screwing over the poor to make the rich more wealthy. Like, I feel like Labour...
Wait, poor people can vote? Damn, old Labour's fucked.
Yeah. Yeah, like, I just think it's pretty obvious that Labour doesn't have a constituency in the centre, and that they keep trying to reach that constituency and losing the voters on the left. So.
Yeah. It's a bummer. They've done a bad job.
Yeah.
It's a shame.
So next we want to talk about... Well, it's NAIDOC week this week. And Zach, maybe you had a story.
Yeah, we wanted to cover a couple of bits of news centering around Indigenous communities. So first off, I just wanted to talk about Rebecca Ma, who is a Wiradjuri woman from the Hunter region in New South Wales, who died in police custody in 2016. You may remember last week we spoke about Tanya Day, a Yorta Yorta woman from Northern Victoria who died in police custody in 2017 after being arrested under a public drunkenness law. Now, Rebecca Ma in New South Wales was arrested for public intoxication, which is a slightly different offence. But the coroner this week in New South Wales found that her death was entirely the fault of the police failing to call her an ambulance or properly searching her when she was first arrested. So one of the really tragic elements of this story is that in the year 2000 in New South Wales, something called the Custody Notification Service was implemented, which basically means when an Indigenous person is arrested, the cops have to call the Aboriginal Legal Service and notify them that an Indigenous person has been arrested. And then the Aboriginal Legal Service will arrange representation or send down, you know, members of the family, whatever, somebody to actually interface with the police. And since that service was introduced in 2000, this is actually the first death in custody that has happened in New South Wales. So the first in 16 years. In this case, Rebecca Maher's case, the custody notification service was not implemented, the Aboriginal Legal Service was not notified, and she later died in custody after the police didn't call her an ambulance, even though they knew that she was extremely intoxicated and had noted that they were concerned for her well-being. So this is another horribly racist and upsetting death in custody. But I guess one thing that we can take from this is that services like the custody notification service are really important and effective in helping Indigenous people survive encounters with the police. So maybe it's something that should be looked at in states like Victoria, where we still have a much bigger problem.
Yeah, I was thinking last week after we were talking about deaths in custody that I'm by no means got any expertise in this field, but it seems to me like a really intractable problem, police violence and systemic racism, and it seems like the kind of thing, like, how do you even start trying to deal with it? But this story about the CNS system shows that there are really simple, practical things that could be implemented, like, literally today, that will save people's lives.
Yep.
And I think that is a sort of hopeful line to look at in this otherwise very upsetting story.
Yeah, totally. And you had something else that was about community-based solutions to Indigenous health issues?
Yeah, totally. So I think with NAIDOC Week, it's important to try and...
It's supposed to be a celebration.
It's supposed to be a celebration, yeah. And it's too easy to find upsetting stuff about how we treat Indigenous people in this country. So this is a more positive story about this organization called Birthing in Our Community, which is a program that's running in Mianjin, I think that's how it's pronounced, on the lands of the Yagara people, which is what white people call Brisbane. And it's a community midwifing and birthing service where Aboriginal women are connected with a midwife who's basically there full time. They've got 24/7 access to a midwife to transport, help so they can get to and from medical appointments. They get help with food, covering rent costs, all sorts of things. And that these midwives are specifically, I think most of them are Aboriginal, and they also are going through sort of the broader organization is focused around trying to make these midwives understand the Aboriginal relationship with birth and connect with those women directly. And the program has just been basically an unmitigated success. It's
cool.
In I think the 2 years that it's been running, they have cut early birth by 50%. And early birth is, I think, the main predicting factor in infant mortality.
Right.
So this kind of program has just made a huge difference to these women. There was an interview with a woman who had sort of been through it and who seemed really ecstatic and who's got 3 kids now. And yeah, so I think that's just such a nice story about Indigenous people helping other Indigenous people and a sign of, again, as with the CNS, there's like relatively simple stuff that we could be doing, like letting people look after themselves.
Yeah.
That will just change people's lives.
Rather than an interventionist approach, take an approach that empowers the community and enables it to actually come together and give them resources to support themselves.
Totally.
And don't tell them how to fucking live their lives.
Using culturally sensitive techniques and knowledge and relationships and approaches. Yeah, I just think that was a really great story that I was really happy to read about.
Very cool. Happy NAIDOC Week. And if there's any cool stories that we missed, please let us know in the comments. All right. So it's time now for the blurst of takes.
It was the best of
takes.
It was the blurst of
takes.
You stupid monkey.
Look, it's always a tough one to pick
the blurst
take. And we so far, we've never picked a blessed take, but this week I think it's taken out by Emma Alberici, who has a blessed take.
So Emma Alberici is the chief economic correspondent for the ABC.
Yeah, that's right. And you may remember her from getting in a little tiff with Malcolm Turnbull last year when she wrote an article saying that trickle-down economics is bullshit and doesn't work. And he got very upset and just decided to attack the ABC over it. And so when you have like a journo who's positioned sort of antagonistically towards the government, you might be tempted to be like, hey, this person seems cool and they have good ideas. And then they might hop on Twitter and they might say something along the lines of, and I quote, "I think all high schools should have the right to do spot checks of students' children's social media accounts to ensure that they comply with the school ethos. It would surely temper some of the crude behavior and language on there. Your thoughts?" She then proceeded to get thoroughly fucking ratioed and did that amazing thing that Australian journalists just love to do. When somebody calls out a stupid thing that they've deliberately said in public, they just dig their heels in, double down, and refuse to admit they've said anything wrong and spend the next week tweeting about, "I'm so attacked."
When I read this quote, I sort of immediately wanted to go on a half-hour-long rant about Michel Foucault.
Oh, and please.
Whether or not it's surprising that prisons resemble schools, barracks, factories, and hospitals.
Boom, get new material.
All of which resemble prisons. And in fact, it's not surprising. But anyway, Zach sort of very politely vetoed going on a big French philosophy rant.
Yeah, you look, just start another podcast. There's nothing stopping you.
I literally will.
Or, sounds great, I'll listen.
Yeah, maybe we'll create a Patreon at some point and produce bonus material that's me talking about French philosophers.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Cool.
I mean, do we need to explain why this is, why having, giving teachers and school administrators the power to check students' phones is a dumb idea? Or do you think that...
As an angsty teenager, admittedly in my late 20s, but as an angsty teenager, my first point of view about this was like, let the kids roam free, right? But I saw some other takes on why this is such a terrible opinion from teachers who are basically like, we're already doing like 1.5 full-time jobs and being paid like 2/3 of a full-time salary.
Mm.
And how about we don't add monitoring 1,000 students, like, full-time social media presence to that job description. Also, from what I've read in the newspaper, kids these days aren't even on Facebook, they're on Snapchat, specifically because adults can't trace it or check it or complain to them about it.
Mm,
so,
smart.
Alberici, your kids are way ahead of you. Don't even fucking bother.
Yeah, and, like, I'm sorry about whatever happened to them that made you tweet this, but... maybe Twitter's not the best place to, like, work out the kinks in your parenting techniques. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Just a thought. Just gonna throw that out there. Maybe, you know, stick to the economics.
Yeah, that seems like a good piece of advice.
You're not chief shitposting correspondent. Oh!
But look, if you do want that position on this podcast, have it.
Please, come and join us. We'd actually love to have you. Like you said, like we said, we like that one thing that you did like a year ago.
We can promise to just completely compliment you the whole time.
Yeah, I'm comfortable with that.
I've never had any journalistic integrity, so...
We're not journalists.
I can fucking piss it off the wall now.
I don't have any regular person integrity. I think we've probably gone on long enough.
Cool. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in. I hope the new gimmick / theme is not feeling too forced, but hopefully it'll get more natural in the future. We're sorry that we didn't choose any of the titles that you suggested.
I'm not sorry.
I'm sorry that we didn't choose any of the titles that you suggested, but look, I think that after a little while you'll get used to it.
Also, this week we were recording in a different space, so I'm sorry if you heard a cat screaming or a washing line falling over, any of those things. Mm. We're very professional, so
thanks.
All of those audio was added on purpose.
Just a shout out to Fury for letting us use their microphone for the last couple of weeks. 100%. I think next week we're going to have to buy our own one.
That's exciting.
So there'll be a whole new adventures in bad audio for you to experience.
And just before we finish, Zach, we've got one more thing to ask from the audience. We want to get your rants.
Yeah, we're thinking of introducing a fun new segment. I don't know, we don't have a name for it yet. Rant of the week. I guess we can't call every segment something of the week, but let's call it rant of the week for the time being. Do a voice recording of 1 minute or less of you ranting about some political issue for the week. Send them in to us via the page. We'll tell you how to do it. And we'll pick our favorite one and play it on the show.
Hell yeah, you can ramble as incoherently as we do. We would love to hear all of your hot takes.
Or, you know, you can tighten it up as well. I'm not opposed to that. Cool.
I think that's us.
Cool. Keep snacking them in the free world. Oh, jeez.
All right.